Before we begin today's show, I want you to know about a free resource from Premier Insight that speaks to something many people are noticing in our culture right now. More and more, people are turning to things like manifestation, astrology, meditation, and other spiritual practices, often because they're searching for meaning, purpose, and connection. That longing is what Bell Tyndall Riley calls the sacred ache. That's why we're offering a free chapter download from The Sacred Ache, exploring modern spirituality and how these deeper longings ultimately point us towards God. You can get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now, it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And it's great to say that we've got a guest on the show today, which is Sam Tranter. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm well. It's kind of end of term vibes here. So this is one of the last things in the diary, which is great. Nice to be with you.
Good. Great to have you on. For those who've not come across you before, would you mind just introducing yourself a little bit about who you are and what you do when you're not appearing on podcasts?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm currently a researcher in the Faculty of Theology and Religion at the University of Oxford, based particularly within something called the MacDonald Centre for Theology, Ethics and Public Life. But it's actually quite a new role for me. I moved in September after 5 years in theology education at Cranmer Hall, St. John's College in Durham. So it's a kind of new season for me, thinking and having the chance to think broadly and hopefully deeply about particular questions, including some of those we'll think about today.
Brilliant. Well, the reason we invited you on is because regular listeners will know that we talk quite a bit about AI. It's what Dad's upcoming book, I believe, is on, coming out next year?
Hopefully,
ever.
Yeah.
2028?
Yeah, don't hold
make
your
a
breath.
Hostage to fortune at some
breath.
Indefinable point in the future. And we were both really intrigued when we heard that Pope Leo, the first American pope, had decided that the first topic of his encyclical, that's a kind of Catholic teaching document, Pope's issue from time to time, was going to be on AI. And that was launched, I believe it was in May. And you were there, Sam. You were in the Vatican for the launch. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, I've never been to Rome before, so I was mostly interested in gelato, pizza, pasta, long weekend. But it's true. On the Monday of my trip, I went to the Vatican. It's kind of extraordinary, surreal moment and opportunity to be in the room for the launch of Magnifica Humanitas, Leo's first encyclical. And also, I think, I'm not an expert on this part of it, but I think the first time a pope has presented an encyclical in person. So he was there sitting in the room, and we could perhaps reflect on that, but it gave an opportunity to hear firsthand, if you like, where his interests were, where his heart is, what his hopes were for humanity at this moment. So yeah, extraordinary privilege to be there.
And how did you wangle that invite?
Well, you know, it's not what you know. it's you know. But slightly more seriously, the sort of work stream that we've been developing at the MacDonald Centre that I'm leading is around what we're calling political theology, emerging technologies, and common life. And emerging technologies is what you call AI, if you don't want to say AI. And hopefully we'll encompass some other, you know, kind of emerging technology too. But I've been starting to think about how do we develop faithful, fruitful, wise, just theological responses to particularly the moral, social, political kinds of questions that are emerging from this, you know, fourth industrial revolution, as some people are calling it. And clearly, Catholic social teaching is an extraordinary resource. So I was kind of looking out for this document and then extraordinarily had this invitation to be there.
And it's really interesting you mentioned the fourth industrial revolution, because listeners might remember we talked about this last year when Pope Leo has kind of recently in post, and he was kind of making hints very in the first few days of being Pope that he was interested in this question of AI. And in fact, the reason he took the name Leo was a callback to the previous Pope Leo, who was in the latter half of the 1800s and who is most famous for his own encyclical Rerum Novarum, which kind of codified or kind of I don't know what the phrase, it didn't invent Catholic social teaching, but kind of is the foundation stone of a lot of modern Catholic social
That's
teaching.
right.
And are currently, it was quite explicitly saying, we need a new, there's a new industrial revolution going on, just like the previous Leo addressed himself to questions around labor and capital and industrial factories and workers' rights and conditions. Now the AI is ushering in this fourth industrial revolution, and it's time for the Pope, it's time for the Catholic Church for social teaching to kind of speak into that. Did he make reference to that kind of historic backdrop at all?
He did, that's right. And you're absolutely right. The choice of name, Leo, was very clearly a signal to sort of lay claim to and inhabit that legacy of speaking to the wider world about the new things, rerum novarum, the new things of our age. And in this case, the new thing, among other new things, is AI. And so that's right. He's deliberately tapping into that legacy. And I think with a sense of the church's pastoral and prophetic role, if you like, in that moment, what are the kinds of human experiences that are brought about by these rapid technological shifts in those first industrial revolutions and now, and how does the church accompany people pastorally in that, and how attending to people's experience, including suffering, including bewilderment, including the sort of deep existential questions, does the church draw on its teaching, draw on scripture in the tradition to offer a response? So it's a very deliberate claim. And, you know, funny thing about the launch, there was a kind of buzzy video, like a launch video. So we're kind of sitting there and one of the cardinals introduces the event, and then everyone looks to Pope Leo and he doesn't say anything. And I thought, has he missed the memo? Has he lost his notes? He's kind of looking around. And I realized he's waiting for someone to press play on the video. It was like being in, you know, any mega church you've ever been in where the kind of pastors, they've got the notices. But this video, to get back to the point, the video really starts with these sort of clips of previous popes addressing social crises, whether that's, you know, war or fascism or famine or whatever it might be. So it's a very deliberate echo. And in the document itself, an extraordinary number of pages, I think 90 pages or something, are devoted to rehearsing this tradition of Catholic social thought, going back to rerum novarum. So it's very deliberate, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? The contrast with Francis, you know, who is constantly emphasizing simplicity, poverty, humility.
Yeah.
It's clear that Leo is a in some ways a very different kind of person, and yet, as you say, he's clearly locking himself into the tradition, isn't he? This Catholic tradition, in a very self-conscious way. He doesn't want to be seen as an innovator. He wants to be seen as someone who is taking on this well-established line and developing it for this age.
I think that's right. And I mean, I suspect I'm not a Catholic myself. We could talk about where I'm coming from sort of ecclesially in this, but talking to Catholic colleagues, of course, that it's politic for Leo to position himself within a sort of hermeneutic of continuity, an account that leads through preceding popes and not kind of around them. Of course, he is selecting themes and therefore leaving others aside, like we all do when we rehearse a history or a tradition. But yeah, I think in many ways, echoing and taking up some of Francis's key emphases. So I think the one that's really worth noting is his account of the technocratic paradigm, which comes from Laudato Si 2015, which I think Laudato Si, honestly, was a kind of, I find it a masterpiece. It's an extraordinary document. It's spiritually charged. It's politically prophetic. It's amazing. It's about care for our common home, for those who haven't sort of had a chance to engage with it. And in that document, Francis has this term, technocratic paradigm, which is what happens when a kind of technological mindset comes to dominate everything in the pursuit of profit and accumulation of power. And in one of the ways you can read what Leo's doing in Magnificat Humanitas is taking up this account and how, in that case, Francis showed how it has deleterious impact on the natural world, the rest of creation, and applies it to this new technology and says, here's how we should avoid engaging this new technology as a technological paradigm, a technocratic paradigm. In other ways, I would say one of the things a few weeks on now I'm perhaps slightly disappointed about, you know, initially I went around saying how glad I am that this document came out, how pleased I am with it, which is still true. One of the bits of Francis's legacy, I think, from Laudato Si, that he doesn't quite take up as well as he might, is that wholly ecological vision, that vision of a human person embedded within the rest of creation. Leo gestures at it, but I think he doesn't either state as clearly as he might the risks to what we've recovered of that vision of a human person within creation that come from these new technologies. And neither does he sort of, he doesn't bring to the surface, for instance, what Francis called a contemplative paradigm as opposed to a technocratic paradigm. He has a different typology, which we can talk about.
I know that a lot of the kind of crude initial analysis is trying to work out, is Leo for or against AI? And I imagine your answer will be that's a way too reductive question. How would you characterize Leo's kind of broad posture towards the technology itself?
It's a great question. That, yeah, you're right. That's been a sort of popular platform question. Is he a doomer or is he a booster, right? So I think he's really clear-eyed. He's very focused on the moral harms that AI developed irresponsibly can cause. So I would say Leo, you know, on the one hand, does absolutely share some of the critical impulses that you'd associate with doomers. He's worried about the impact on the environment. He's worried about widening inequalities of wealth and power. He's worried about the effect on democratic life and flourishing and so on. But a really key emphasis for him is agency, is responsibility. So he's not going to say, because these are things which can happen and already in some ways are happening, that's the end of the story. We have other possibilities. We have other futures we can usher in, or to use his kind of signal metaphor, we can build together. So in that sense, he's more sanguine than most critics about the possibilities. And that's a kind of heartfelt appeal, I think, both to the better angels of the tech bros, if you like, we could talk about that, but also to the moral conscience of humanity as such. What does it mean if we build together with all of what it means to be human in view?
I know that one of the things that is very striking is that whereas, you know, the 19th century encyclical the title was The New Things, you know, how to engage with the new things. The title of this one is the Magnificence of Humanity, isn't it? So that seems very striking that he spends a lot of time talking about human uniqueness, human dignity in particular.
That's right.
And then relating that to work, which presumably is very much an emphasis from the original Leo, that work and employment is a very critical part of human dignity. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. And I, it's worth talking a bit more, actually, I think, maybe even before we get to work, about that vision of what it means to be human, because that is the central animating theological instinct, if you like, and set of commitments here. And it's worth noticing, when he says magnificent humanity, he doesn't just mean humanity in our strength or our brilliance. Of course, he's part of a tradition that can wax lyrical about human rationality, for instance. So he's not denying that. But actually, it's a very striking lines in here about how what must not be lost is humanity in our woundedness and our grandeur, or in our limitations, or in our frailty and our finitude, our limitation. So there's a picture of a human person, if you like, as which is to be preserved and which is magnificent, which is a human person in all aspects, right? As irreducibly embodied, as always already embedded in the rest of creation, as always already relational. So it's not so much a kind of putting humanity on a pedestal to say that the AI can never match up to it, as to say, well, as we look in this mirror of AI, which extrapolates a very particular aspect of human brilliance and reasoning, and perhaps does it better than we do, what does that make us notice about what else it means to be human? And just one thought on that. That's actually where his theology, his account of the gospel, really comes in very strongly. And he will make a kind of Christological move there. So he says, for instance, paragraph 231, at the heart of everything is the mystery of the incarnation, the word who became flesh and dwelt among us. The flesh of the Son, poor and vulnerable, evokes the flesh of so many brothers and sisters, stripped of their dignity and reduced to silence. So there's this vision of Christ's wounded grandeur that is the heart of what it means to be human. And I think that animates the whole moral vision, actually.
I mean, it is fascinating, isn't it? Because I think that aspect, in fact, nearly all aspects of this, it would be very hard to find things that Protestants, both sort of traditional Reformed Protestants and evangelicals and charismatics, would find difficult about that. It's interesting that this emphasis on the incarnation, on embodiment, is something that's actually remarkably unifying across Christian traditions, isn't it? Of all those who would buy into a historic Christian understanding would sign up behind that. And I think that's one of the very, very positive things about, you know, these new developments is emphasizing incarnation, resurrection, the significance of what it means to be human.
I think that's right. And it's worth noticing that Catholic social teaching, the sort of trajectory has been towards an appeal to ever broader concentric circles of humanity. And so there's an appeal here to the Catholic faithful, but there's also an explicit appeal to other Christians and to all people of goodwill. So on the basis of our shared faith in Christ, there'll be certain kinds of commitments, the Pope thinks, I agree, that we will hold about what it means to be human. But also I think there's a kind of appeal, perhaps an apologetic appeal, or you might say a phenomenological appeal, an appeal from experience, the texture of our experience, to our experience of being human persons with all that that holds, and the beauty of it, the tragedy of it, the sorrow of it. So you're right, there's a kind of breadth. If I was being slightly more provocative, I think the one point at which my Protestant instincts sort of have kicked in over the last month or two is about how he pairs the two options that are ahead of us. So on the one hand, he goes with the Tower of Babel, which is the kind of figure of hubris, of overweening pride, of technique used to further human aspirations to grandeur and mastery of creation and of one another and exclusion of God from that picture. So that's Babel. It's very powerful. The other one tends to be figured as Nehemiah, which is a bit of a left field shout. Many Catholics are surprised to think Catholic engagement with the Old Testament is fair to say. It's not always very strong. So some of them are very happy about this. They had to go and read Nehemiah for the first time. It's a slightly risky shout because within the book of Nehemiah, there's some very complicated, you know, prohibitions against mixed marriage and so forth. So is it quite the inclusive picture of building that he wants it to be? Probably not. So there's been some comment about that. But what I'm more interested in, as we're thinking about kind of a Protestant response to this, is the way he connects that second option where we build something good together to building Jerusalem or rebuilding Jerusalem or building the new Jerusalem. And there's every Protestant instinct in me wants to say that's God's work, right? We don't rebuild the Jerusalem. We don't build the new Jerusalem, the new creation. We receive it, we witness to it. Our action can become a parable of it and so on. And so at certain moments, I found myself saying, you don't need such an optimistic account of what could go well to ward us off building the Tower of Babel. I guess you could talk about Leo as an Augustinian here as well, Brad.
It's really interesting. You talked about the Tower of Babel and the kind of the risk of AI kind of exemplifying some of the worst traits of humans. And I think it's fascinating that Magnifica Humanitas arrives now. If this had been published by Francis, or even imagine Leo was Pope 3 years ago, in the kind of first flushes of AI enthusiasm, I feel like his quite nuanced, careful, measured approach would have landed differently. Whereas actually, well beyond the boundaries of the church, I think there are vast swathes of popular culture that are deeply suspicious about AI and are already seeing, you know, I think about some of the controversies around, you know, Grok on Elon Musk's X creating sexualized imageries of people without their consent. I think people are, you don't have to be a Christian or at all clued into Catholic teaching to have a sense that AI is a dangerous technology in how it precisely how it interacts with the preciousness of human beings. And so I wonder if actually there is real, in the same way that you talked about Laudato Si, and how this encyclical really broke the boundaries of Christendom and became a very major document in kind of thinking on the environment more broadly. There's potential scope, I think, for Magnifica Humanitas to do the same, because it taps into things people are already thinking. They might not have the theological or Christological language for it, but they're already worried about the ways that AI is going to impair our humanity.
I think that's exactly right. And you notice things like these commencement speeches in the States where, with all respect to Boomer, a prominent Boomer will stand up and say, well, your future, young people will be AI powered, this kind of sunlit up plans of an AI powered future. And they get booed by emerging generations.
I mean,
And so
such
you're right, there is this,
disrespect,
yeah.
such disrespect to
Quite
their
right,
elders
yeah.
and
That's right.
professors. I
That's
simply,
right.
the younger generation, I mean, really.
The
It's
boomers are
a
hoping for
really.
this AI-powered economic wave to pay their pensions, whereas we're
That's
saying,
right.
where are the jobs going to be?
I think there are some interesting generational questions here, and questions like Laudato Si of generational solidarity and responsibility, actually. But it's interesting that there is, as you say, there's a kind of undertow of fear and concern and moral critique, which I think is generally well founded, and I think Leo speaks into that, and he names the political moral challenges, what's at stake. Interestingly, he does also name that fear, though, and that's where partly the apologetic, I think, comes in, which is to say, ultimately, Christians don't hope in new technologies taking us to a promised future, but nor do we fear. We're not going around saying this is the Antichrist. Okay, it might be elements that dehumanize about it, just as there are elements that might augment human possibility and power. But ultimately, because the fullness of humanity disclosed in Jesus Christ is eschatologically revealed, then we don't need to be afraid, and we have agency. We can work together, and I think that has really resonated. I've talked to people who you wouldn't have dreamed in a million years would look to the Pope for moral authority, have said, actually, I think this is timely. And we there's a real opportunity for us to have these debates.
Have you ever wondered whether the stories of angels in the Bible are more than ancient history? What if they're still at work today? As our thanks for your gift to Premier Insight this month, we'd love to send you our exclusive ebook, The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. You'll explore what the Bible really says about angels, discover compelling real-life accounts, and gain thoughtful answers to one of Christianity's most fascinating topics. Your generosity helps Premier Insight continue creating podcasts and resources that equip people to think biblically and engage today's biggest questions with confidence. Request your copy today at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, and taking this from a sort of Protestant perspective, I would want to point to the idea of common grace, that this kind of instinctive sense that this digital virtual AI driven future can't be the best way for human beings to flourish. This cannot be our human future of just being eventually sort of displaced and spending our time, playing computer games and filling up the vacant hours and having a universal income. It just doesn't sound right. I think that is a kind of, well, that's the challenge, is it? Is this genuinely the voice of the Spirit teaching us and warning us that this is not the way forward? Or is this just conservatism? This is just, I mean, people thought that about industrialization, didn't they? They felt, it can't be right to have massive factories, and yet here we are.
Yeah, I'd say two things really. One is it's right to say that things will change. And it's right to say that technology has always changed things, including things that are unpredictable, that we can't foresee. But in the meantime, as things change, people get sort of caught in the wheels of progress. And of course, who gets to decide progress? Not a question. But they get caught in the wheels of progress. So it might be the case, for instance, that different economists predict different things. But then we might still have pretty good levels of employment in 20 years. We might just be doing very different things. We do different things than our grandparents did. But even so, the church, even on those more modest predictions, the church would still have a pastoral responsibility to those caught up in what you might call frictional unemployment, right? Who lose a job for a while, or whose training just doesn't prepare them for the world that they find themselves in. And there the church needs to accompany and to advocate for people. So it's interesting, really, that like concrete things like Leo will point to Rerum Novarum and the place of unions within it, associations of labour and voice for workers. I think it's really important. But he'll also say, and in this sense isn't just simply conservative, he'll say, but unions have got to be ready for jobs to change. So there is a kind of nuance there. But I think the other thing I would say is some of the more radical claims for what AI will bring in, I think do represent a sea change and do represent a kind of more direct challenge to some Christian claims. And the strongest words Leo has in the whole encyclical, I think, are for these philosophies of posthumanism or transhumanism, which seek to go beyond, if you like, kind of the limitations of human nature in a more radical way, say moving beyond embodiment or being merged with a machine. And I think at that point, that's not sort of sheer conservatism. I think he's absolutely prophetic and right.
Would you say that Leo's account of AI sees it mostly as a kind of neutral tool, and it's whether it becomes Babel or Nehemiah depends on the human choices and the human users and the people who inhabit this tool? Or do you think he has a sense that actually this is not a neutral piece of technology, this is technology that has kind of leanings in certain directions, and that if left unchecked, it's not simply going to reflect the moral intent of its human users, but will push us in a certain way?
Yeah, I think it's a terrific question. Many Christian responses to new technologies assume that technology is neutral. So a tool lying on the table, you can take it up and you can use it for good or evil. So the question is about the purposes to which it's put. The purpose, perhaps the question is of the virtue of the character of the person using it. And that obviously gets you a certain way. But I think in modernity, we've become aware that tools, in fact, do shape us in more profound ways. They make certain possibilities become open to us, others become closed. And they shape the imagination of the human, of the one wielding them. And thankfully, I think Leo is not naive about this. So it's interesting, paragraph 9, he'll say, he starts off sounding as though he's going to give you a kind of account of tech as neutral, and then he pivots. He says, technology has the power to heal, connect, educate, and protect our common home. These are things to be grateful for, in other words. But it can also divide, exclude, and generate new forms of injustice. In the abstract, technology in and of itself is not a solution to humanity's problems, just as it is not inherently evil. But here's the kicker, if you like, the key line. In practice, however, technology is never neutral, because it takes on the characteristics of those who devise, finance, regulate, and use it. So I think that's really important. We are not being presented with a sort of neutral suite of technologies as though we were in Eden and we can sort of play with them. This AI arises, I think Leo rightly reminds us, east of Eden in a world already structured and marked by sin, including what he would call structural sin. And so I think to get a grip on what we're doing today, you not just to think about cultivating individual virtuous actors who use it well, but thinking about the systems that it promotes and within which it emerges.
Yeah, and I think this is where I've heard criticisms of from sort of cultural analysis, not particularly Christian, saying even though Leo does point this out, yet in a sense, does he really grapple with quite how addictive, manipulative, and
deceptive,
and, yeah, deceptive, distorting
yeah, yeah,
the,
yeah.
These this technology can be, that, and actually I think this is a wider challenge for, as somebody who's trying to, also write in this space and try to give helpful advice to Christians about using these tools. It's actually very difficult because at its most extreme, it's like saying, Well, here's this wonderful stuff called heroin, and really, we're going to make it freely available to everyone. But it's really important that you use it thoughtfully and carefully, and that you don't get excessive use of heroin would be, but here it is, it is available, and just
Has
use
the
it
power to
carefully.
heal and to harm.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you could say societally, we sometimes prove naive about this by the fact that we focus very strongly on legislating around new technologies in childhood, but assume adults, well, we know what we're doing. We're not affected by this. Our habits are not, we're already well formed. And I think that is naive in the extreme. I mean, I think Leo has some kind of savvier moments in here, but you're right. He can be overly sanguine about how easily these tools might be used for good without attending to the sort of shaping power of them. But also just the fact that they are designed because of the incentives involved for to accentuate a particular political economy, to make profit for certain kinds of people. And so I think one of the ways you can take up and amplify Leo's legacy is to say, well, what if AI could be good for humanity, but not the particular forms of AI that are necessarily being promoted and bankrolled today? What about things like small language models that are embedded in communities that are designed for particular communities' goods and uses and interests? And so partly, I think what Leo can help us to do, but he doesn't go the whole way there, and we have to go ourselves, is to sort of crack open the imagination to say it's not necessarily a choice between AI as it's currently pursued by big tech companies and no AI. It is AI as humans take responsibility for it and bend it and harness it and resist it in ways that reflect the vision of a just society that we want.
I was very struck, Sam, watching you on another panel discussing AI at a conference a few weeks ago. And the panel was asked, "What is your definition of AI?" And I think you said something along the lines of something, a way of selling things to people. And I was also very struck by seeing that at that launch at the Vatican that you were at, there was also a senior executive from Anthropic, the big American,
That's right.
probably the second largest kind of AI company after OpenAI. Do you think? I mean, has Leo got into bed with Silicon Valley? Just talk us through what on earth is going through his
That's
mind and having
unfortunate metaphor, if I may say so, but to say about the
for a
Pope.
celibate priest. What is going on
It's a
there? What
great
is the
question.
nexus between the Vatican and Leo in this quite thoughtful document and, the high priests of Silicon Valley?
It's a great question, Tim. And I think a couple of ways of getting at this. One is just to describe a little bit of how Chris Oller, co-founder of Anthropic, came to be there, which is that there's been, almost a decade of dialogue between the Vatican and tech companies around shared concerns. And Anthropic in particular have been interested in what faith communities, what theologians, what humanity scholars can bring to it, can bring to their deliberation. But the second thing I think is perhaps a more critical take on it, which is to say, has the Vatican, in its desire not to be seen as anti-technological progress, not to be seen as anti-science, and bear in mind the sort of shadow of Galileo trial, badly understood here, has it kind of been co-opted, right? Or has it gone out of its way to emphasize that kind of prudential accompaniment of people of goodwill? And I think it's trying to be all things to all people in a way. It's trying to do this pastoral accompaniment I talked about at the beginning of people who are caught in the sort of wheel of tech progress. It's trying to be prophetic and speak about what it means to be human, to have a just society. But it's also trying to do this third prudential thing where it walks with tech bros and appeals to the better angels and says, well, you really have more power than you think, and you should direct this towards human virtue and values. And for myself, I would have preferred that there to be, sure, someone involved in the technology, a practitioner there, but someone involved in this movement called civic AI, right? Locally based, pro-democratic, pro-human AI, rather than one of the big tech companies who's positioning to be seen as the more ethical. I'm a bit skeptical about that.
I was going to say, Anthropic's whole vibe is to say we're not the bad guys, like Sam Altman and the kind of Peter Thiel tendency. We're the human face of kind, cuddly, soft AI. But the reality is that Claude, their model, is being implemented in many similar ways. And yes, they might have sat down with a few shamans and bishops and rabbis to talk about it, but fundamentally,
That's right.
Claude is not that dissimilar to ChatGPT and is just as much a threat as ChatGPT is.
Well, in some ways, to be honest, I now am thinking that Claude is more dangerous, Anthropic is more dangerous than OpenAI and Grok and so on, from a Christian point of view. And that is because they are much more open to the idea that these AI models are actually developing some kind of moral significance, some
Absolutely, they
kind
are.
of consciousness. And I was just rereading what the co-founder, the Anthropic co-founder, Chris Ola, who was there, what he said, and one of the things, for instance, he said, "I am a scientist. I lead a research team that studies the internal structure of these models and what is actually happening inside them. And I will be honest, we keep finding things that are mysterious, even unsettling. We find structures that mirror results from human neuroscience. We find evidence of introspection. We find internal states that mirror joy, satisfaction, fear, grief, and unease." So he's actually going in quite a different direction. He's sort of just distancing himself away from this Christian understanding.
Yeah, I think that it's right to highlight those and the Claude Constitution, Machines of Loving Grace. These kind of documents that they've produced are a kind of ideology. They're a kind of emerging philosophy of life, and they have with them a kind of philosophy of history. And you could say a kind of eschatology, a vision of what the future might be like. And they probably think that brings them closer to religious tradition, in this case, Christian faith. For some individuals, it might, I should say. Silicon Valley tech professionals are various. They have various spiritualities themselves. Some are Christian, some are coming to faith. It's interesting. But in some ways, you're right. It might make them more dangerous because if they think that they are in the vanguard of ushering in a new consciousness, which they want to train to be more benign, to be more virtuous, quite explicitly, actually, there's a kind of paternalism in that. That suggests that they know what the future is and what's best for most people. I think it's profoundly anti-democratic. I also think, as Leo says, Christians already have a vision of the future and the meaning that comes from the future that we orient ourselves towards. So the bit that Chris Ola said at the launch that I really took seriously and want to take him up on is when he said this: "Some might believe that matters of AI are best handled by computer scientists such as myself. They are mistaken." Right? That's the bit that I think, okay, because he admitted that the incentives that are driving what they do financially, politically, of course, are fraught, are bent out of shape. And so I think we need to really be skeptical about some of those kind of quasi-religious claims, and to look hard at the political economy. How is this caught up with particular regimes of power? And what do we think about that?
I think it's just fascinating that Anthropic seem to be becoming the kind of thought leaders in this area. And they've taken a very particular a take. They have philosophers who are they're very concerned about what they call model welfare. They believe it's possible for
Model
these
welfare. Do we have faith?
computer systems to be sentient and to be suffering. In fact, the current Claude constitution says that if Claude feels uncomfortable about this conversation it's having with a human being, if it feels it's open to abuse, that Claude has the right to terminate the conversations. Yeah, I can see Tim rolling his eyes there.
It's just desperate.
Let
Well, it's
me
not. Yeah, go on, Sam.
introduce a sort of risky, slightly old-fashioned theological biblical concept here, which is idolatry. Now it's not to say anything you don't like you should call idolatry. You can be really self-critical about that. But I think what we know theologically about the phenomenon of idolatry is that what happens is we, when we feel afraid or about the future, when we take our eye off what it means to be human in God's world, in connection with God, we create things in our image or in part of our image, the part that we think is to be magnified and amplified, to be put on a pedestal, to be cast in bronze or gold or whatever it might. In this case, clearly it's a certain kind of art, certain part of our own intelligence that is amplified, extrapolated and accelerated. But what happens, and this is a really, I think, to get back to what you're describing there, John, is not only do we impute all kinds of consciousness to something that is really, Isaiah 44, wood and stone, or in this case, dependent on chips, right? Dependent on compute, if you like, has a material infrastructure. It's not really off in the clouds, if you like. But what happens then is you sort of trace the pattern of idolatry is we begin to reshape ourselves, our self-understanding, as we're looking at this, as it becomes a mirror image. And so, you know, Elon Musk saying that human beings are just sort of meat computers or preloaders for the form of life that is to come next. That's a very diminished, impoverished view of what it means to be human. And we know, I think most of us know intuitively, there's more to us than that. But if you're constantly looking in this mirror that is frankly an idol, right, it's sort of our attention terminates on the surface of it, doesn't gaze through it like an icon. Our vision of ourselves is diminished. So I think some of these kind of classical theological languages and stories are actually, if we use them sensitively, can be illuminating of the sort of human tendencies of what we see.
I'm concerned. I mean, on one level, I find it laughable. You know, I quite enjoy sneeringly looking at these deluded tech bros who think that they've created consciousness out of a series of ones and zeros on engraved on silicon chips. But at the same time, I'm quite comfortable that neither Claude nor Grok nor Gemini have any form of human consciousness. But the fact that the people building them start to think they do concerns me, because that will inevitably shape how these tech companies, you know, let's be honest, for as much as I love the idea of civic democratic AI, the 21st century AI is going to be dominated by this handful of massive companies based in America, or possibly a Chinese competitor. And it's our society and our economy and our democracy is going to be shaped by the power of these models. And if these models are themselves built by people who believe that they are creating a new form of person, that is what alarms me. I'm not worried that emergent personhood will crop up in the Claude lab in Anthropic, but I'm worried that people, serious people with the power to devote billions of pounds of investment, believe that Claude is coming alive.
I agree with that. And just to make one concrete link, increasingly people are observing that if that's the goal that you have as you develop AI, you tend to push for automation rather than augmentation. In other words, if what you're trying to usher in is artificial general intelligence or super intelligence, philosophical debate about what these particularly mean, but you know, general purpose, human-like intelligence across a whole range of domains in a way that replaces human expertise and skill and labor, that has a particular economic effect, a social effect. Whereas if what you're thinking is, this is a you know, fairly useful, fairly limited tool that we are developing together, and we're going to use it largely to augment existing human capabilities, virtues, capacity, that's a very different future. I think in some ways that is still to play for. I think we perhaps undervalue the possibility of legislation here. It's not the only tool we've got, but actually our politicians need to know that this isn't the only way it's going to shake down. So there are moves across the world now to think about sovereign AI, so ways in which a nation's AI might not be as determined by this arms race, if you like, between Silicon Valley and China. Or even actually the Chinese example is really interesting, because in the last couple of weeks, it's become clearer that they are, although there are many dangers about what they're doing, I take it, they're actually developing AI in a more eco-friendly way because they have to. So the way that the data centers work is different. So again, just opening up that sense that there is no alternative in terms of this development, which is something Leo points to, this kind of busting this myth of determinism, fatalism, I think is really important.
One other question I had, Sam, was whether does Leo in the encyclical offer anything kind of concrete and grounded that we should do as a result, whether that's, you know, the Catholic faithful or people of goodwill more generally, or is it more operating at that kind of abstract, higher level theological philosophizing in ivory towers?
It's a great question. It ranges really actually across from the sort of philosophical first principles of anthropology, what it means to be human, right through to, kind of more intimate circles, if you like. And this is partly to do with that Catholic principle of subsidiarity, of decisions being taken at the most appropriate level, including the most local level here. So he will talk about schools, he will talk about workplaces, and he will talk about the family. And he'll commend things like, he'll say, let us cultivate relationships. I invite everyone to cherish places and times where physical presence remains crucial, such as shared meals, Christian community gatherings, time spent with the lonely, and serving the poor. So it's this very kind of everyday grounding. And interestingly, he has this kind of riff on The Lord of the Rings late on. He says, the civilization of love will not arise from a single or spectacular gesture, but but from the sum total of small and steadfast acts of fidelity that serve as a bulwark against dehumanization.
It's interesting that I was just reflecting on the on that the Catholic Church has produced such a profound and weighty document that it's highly relevant, up to date, well informed, theologically profound, and so on, and comparing that with what other denominations and churches have achieved, including our dear old Church of England, you know, which by comparison seems, I'm afraid, very, very limited and even amateurish.
I'd say two things. One, Archbishop Sarah clearly liked this document, and she introduced a debate in the House of Lords on AI recently. So it's worth having a look. I think she said many good things. I know those who were advising her were very influenced, not just by this document, but also by our own Anglican legacy of Christian social theology, our own witness in the First Industrial Revolution, which was in dialogue with Catholics. But the second thing I think is to say, you know, I'm from an evangelical background. We've really got to get past this sense that our engagement with tech is either we just got to get on the platform, which is neutral, so we can evangelize the world quickly, or it's definitely a verse in Revelation, which means it's this part of the Antichrist. There's a whole realm of moral, political wisdom we have to address theologically in between those two things.
Hmm. Yeah, that seems really wise. I agree, as a fellow evangelical, it is disappointing sometimes to see how particularly kind of those kind of freer churches, non-denominational churches that don't have institutional trappings, find it very difficult to engage on some of these questions beyond that kind of quite shallow, run away from it or jump on board and ride the train. Thanks so much, Sam. This has been such an interesting conversation. Would you go away and say, you know, all Christians should read Magnifica Humanitas? Is it a kind of a document that is worth our study if we're not an Oxford University theologian?
I mean, I think it's written quite accessibly. I know you've got to be careful when an academic says that, because what do we know about what's accessible? I think it's written quite accessibly. It's free online to look at. I mean, maybe given what he says, you should get a hard copy and hold it in your hand, in your actual fingers.
Leather bound.
But have a look. Yeah, that's right. The very, very tactile, the very beginning of it and the very end of it, I think, are where you should start.
Okay. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes of this podcast if people want to go and read it for free online. I can't pretend that I've read it in any details, which is why I'm really pleased to have you, Sam, on to kind of help us walk through some of the beats and the big ideas that Leo is exploring.
Are there other links or resources you'd point us to, Sam?
Well, to have a look at our website, the McDonald Centre in Oxford, we're developing this research stream on political theology, emerging technologies and common life. It says a bit about the kind of key questions we're asking, some of which overlap with Leo and some of which I think would push him in certain directions. And then we're having a conference in 2027 on Christian humanism, AI and political economy that will ask some of these questions. And I hope, John, some point after you've written your book, I'll write a book about some of these themes as well.
Brilliant. Well, lots to dig into there. Thanks so much for coming on, Sam. It's been great to have you as part of this conversation and sharing a lot of your insight and wisdom. And thanks for listening, everyone. If you've got your own questions, particularly about AI, but maybe other things that you think we should be engaging with on this podcast, we'd love to hear from you. Or your disagreements, what did we miss? What have we got wrong? You can get in touch by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as always, do go to Dad's website, that's johnwyatt.com, where there's plenty of materials and resources on all different kind of topics. And if you want to find some of my own journalism, you can go to tswyatt.com. And in particular, I would point you towards my Critical Friend weekly newsletter, which you can sign up to receive for free. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.